This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, walhamdulillahi rabbil alameen, wa salatu wa salamu ala nabiyyina Muhammad wa ala alihi wa ashabihi ajma'in. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome back to this third installment of this series in Black History Month. We're examining Black Muslims in history and you know, talking about an array of topics. And I'm joined, of course, by my special guest, the esteemed scholar, Dr. Sheikh Abdul Hakim Quick. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And we have another great session for today. And we're trying to, again, move along this kind of history chronologically, as at least as we see it. And we're now looking into Islam's interaction, or I should say, the Western world's interaction with the first real Muslim migrants, or, you know, peoples who came over. And we're looking at the Atlantic slave trade and the first contact, really, with Islam in North America. Now, when we talk about the Atlantic slave trade and the, you know, this genocide, really, of many Africans' peoples, oftentimes, I guess, as Muslims, we don't really look at it from the scope of an atrocity that happened to Muslims. We think about the Atlantic slave trade as something that happened to African or Black people that were brought over, stolen from their homelands, brought over to many places around the world, the Caribbean, places in South America, and obviously in North America as well. Yeah. But as Muslims, we don't really grieve this as something that would have happened to Muslims, because there were a large, you know, percentage of the Muslims who were taken from Africa actually were Muslim. And they had a long history, a thriving Islam within their cultures. So why do you think that's the case? Why don't we as Muslims, first of all, grieve the incident of the Atlantic slave trade with the undertone of thinking that, hey, these were actually Muslims that were taken from their homes, the same way we would, for example, grieve other Muslims who'd been, you know, in other atrocities?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, wa salatu wasalam wa rasulullah wa ba'd. When we look at the Atlantic slave trade and, you know, the whole issue of the transport of human beings from Africa to the Americas, again, we're stuck with a notion or a discourse which was set by the European scholars. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, they wrote Islam out of history. And we find it from, you know, saying the Dark Ages in Europe, you know, which was the golden age of Islam.
Right.
And so that this mentality of opposition, wanting to write Islam out of the history, or to demonize Muslims, give them a negative role in history, mm-hmm. It has affected scholarship. So therefore, people associated Islam with slavery. Mm. And, you know, we understood that the first Muslims who entered Africa were actually refugees.
Yep.
And that, you know, the whole issue of slavery was not an issue for a long period of time, although slavery was a worldwide institution.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, a wrong notion of Arabs in West Africa trading slaves to the Europeans is also a wrong notion, because there were no Arabs in West Africa, mm-hmm. especially down on the coastlines and whatnot.
Right.
So that could not have happened in the way that it was projected. So basically, we get this wrong image,
mm-hmm.
And it sort of blots out, you know, the real role of Muslims and the personality of Muslims and, you know, what happened. So it's important, again, when we go back to real research, you know, to say what is true.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not that all of the slaves were Muslims,
right.
But to recognize, and it's very clear now in African history, it's in all the universities, they recognize
mm-hmm.
that somewhere around 15% to 30%, you know, of the slaves and political prisoners taken to the Americas were Muslims.
Mm.
So this is not the way it was in the past. If you studied history in the 18th century, 19th century, up until the 20th century, middle of the 20th century, in the Western world, you would think that all of the slaves brought to the Americas were non-Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
But that has changed radically, fortunately, with research and with people speaking out.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's becoming part of the discourse. But it's really important, not only for the general public, but for Muslims in particular, to be aware of this fact.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes Muslims tend to read only Islamic books or things that they think have to do with Islam. And when they look at the spread of Islam,
mm-hmm.
they may think that Islam did not go south of the Sahara.
Right.
I've actually seen maps to show the Muslim world north of the Sahara, not recognizing that south of the Sahara were huge Islamic empires.
Right.
Which played a big role in the history of Africa Muslim world and the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because I think a lot of people who would associate themselves as Afrocentrics or people that do have this study or affinity towards Africa, they also write out Islam from Africa. Perhaps they have this negative connotation of the Arab quote-unquote slave trade and the persecution of black and African peoples at that time. Can you clarify that? Because I think on both sides, people are trying to either eliminate Islam from Africa, as in there was no Islam in Africa, or vice versa, they're trying to take away Africans from Islam, as in Africans did not make any contributions to Islam. So can you talk about the reality of that particular notion that people try and disassociate Islam from Africa as if there were no Muslims within Africa to begin with?
Yeah. Well, you know, the first thing we have to recognize is that, you know, from the early days of the foundation of Islam, even before the Muslims went to Medina from Mecca, they went into Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So from that early time, there were African Muslims, and the continent itself was intimately connected to the message of Islam.
Right.
And that's the way it's always been. Huge Muslim populations on the African continent. Some people would say the majority of African people are Muslims.
Right.
Definitely, if you include West Africa, which is above Central Africa, and you know, you would see that the majority are Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important for us, again, to come out of that Eurocentric approach, which is centered in Europe, but to try to look at it from a more objective way, you know, taking in what happened in Africa, what happened to the Muslims. One of the distortions that happens is that people try to equate at the Atlantic slave trade with slavery that happened on the east coast of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we have to recognize and we accept the fact that there were Muslims who deviated from the original message of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, because he liberated the slaves.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no record of Muslims slave raiding, you know, in the early generations of Islam. But some of the kings and empires that came later, copying other nations of the world, got involved in slavery because it was a worldwide institution.
Mm-hmm.
Islam was phasing it out. The reality was, and historians will say, that up until the 17th, 18th century, you could say that 75% of the people in the world were actually slaves. Now, this is shocking because slavery, feudalism, where you have the feudal European lord and the serfs,
right,
that's a form of slavery.
Mm.
When the Romans enslaved the Slavic people and the Germans, that was slavery. The word slave comes from Slav, like Slavic people.
Right.
Chinese had slaves. Indians had slaves. Even the First Nations people in the Americas had slaves. Because in the ancient world, you were either free or you were subjugated in one way or another.
Right.
So there's different forms, you know, that slavery took.
Mm-hmm.
And but the difference was that the Atlantic slave trade specifically wanted to get darker complexion people, and the viciousness of it and the numbers of the people were so great, and the effect on the people has never been seen in the history of humanity.
Mm.
Some scholars try to equate the two, and it's very clear to show that they're not the same. Because in the Atlantic slave trade, I can see the descendants of the slaves very clearly.
Mm.
Millions of slaves taken into the Americas. You see their descendants in Brazil, in the Caribbean, in the United States. You can clearly see Afro-American people of the Americas.
Mm-hmm.
If Arab slave trade, which was basically from the east coast of Africa and some going across the Sahara, if it was the same, where'd all the black people go?
Mm.
You can't say Sudan because that is the land of the blacks.
Right.
You can't say Egypt because they're already Africans.
Yeah.
If you look at Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Kuwait, Iraq, you know, Syria, where are all the black people? They're not there because the numbers were nowhere near the size of the numbers going into the Americas.
Mm.
And there was a form which did not come until somewhere around the 18th century when the Romanis, first fighting with the Swahilis on the east coast of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
They defeated the Portuguese, But they saw that the Portuguese had a trade in slaves, so they got involved. Mm-hmm. So the Omanis did get involved, but it was only a 150-year period, and the numbers are nowhere the numbers mm-hmm. that actually went into the Americas.
Now, what exactly happened during the Atlantic slave trade? We spoke a little bit about this particular phenomenon, but maybe break it down for us. Yeah. You know, where did these people come from, mm-hmm. and how were they delivered over to the New World?
Right. Okay, first we have to understand that when Columbus and the early Spanish and Portuguese came across and they reached the Americas, of course, Columbus was lost. Mm-hmm. He thought he was in India, and he bumped into a new world. But it wasn't a new world for the world mm-hmm. because 75 million people were living there, you know, and many for over 10,000 years.
Yeah.
So he bumped into a huge world. And the early colonists basically stayed along the coastlines, east coast of the United States, and some of the Caribbean islands, and then the east coast of Brazil, Guyana, you know, and that part of South America.
Mm-hmm.
And what they recognized is that the fertile land in that region could be exploited in order to raise crops, to grow crops
mm-hmm.
That would be of great commercial value, like cotton,
right.
Tobacco, sugar cane, right, and a number of crops, and these three in particular, you see, they revolutionized Europe.
Right.
The cotton given the people clothing, tobacco became an addiction.
Right.
Sugar cane is sugar, that's your sweets.
It's everywhere.
And Europe did not have sweets before like this.
Wow.
So they went crazy with it.
Mm.
So therefore, people wanted to grow cane, they wanted to grow cotton, they wanted to grow tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
And this tropical area in the southern part of the United States, in the Caribbean and Brazil, it needed people who could work for little or no money, also who had great skills and who could be subjugated. They originally tried to subjugate the native people
mm-hmm.
and the Amerindians in the Caribbean, but it didn't work because that's their land.
Mm-hmm.
And when they captured the native people, they would either just sit down and not, you know, die, or they would escape and run away.
Mm.
And when they went into the forest, that was their land.
You couldn't catch them.
So you couldn't catch them. So that was a waste of time.
Yeah.
The rich colonists looked at poor Europeans
mm-hmm.
because there was class amongst the Europeans.
Right.
So it was the aristocrats and there were the poor people who were leaving Europe because of the plagues and the famines. They tried to enslave poor European people. That wouldn't work either
mm.
because they were different than the natives and they could, you know, gain money and become rich.
Mm-hmm.
They refused. So they looked to Africa.
Mm-hmm.
In West Africa and Central Africa, you have people who are dark complexion, so they're easy to identify.
Mm-hmm.
They have thriving societies, huge societies in especially West Africa. They know how to grow these crops. They can live in tropical climate. That's their climate.
Right.
So they're the perfect people if you can get them across.
Mm-hmm.
And so they started to trade on the coastline. And first they found African nations that were warring against each other. And it was the way of the world at that time that political prisoners or prisoners of war would be integrated into the societies. They would become slaves.
Right.
And instead of killing everybody, they would make you a slave, meaning you're going to work for them
mm-hmm.
or you're going to be integrated into their society.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Europeans first set up colonies, forts, and they would literally purchase these prisoners of war and then take them across the Atlantic, and then they intermarried and they created a mulatto class.
Mm-hmm.
They built up their forts, and then when they had enough strength, they raided themselves for slaves. And many of the empires resisted the Europeans. There were Muslims also who resisted. The famous Sheikh Nasr al-Din, this is 1673, in what is now Mauritania. He resisted,
mm-hmm.
clearly. Also, the imam, the al-mami of Futatoro, and this is around 1789, he threatened the governor of St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
This is your area of Senegal and that region.
Right.
Threatened him.
Mm-hmm.
Don't take any Muslims or any people out of here.
Mm-hmm.
So Muslims tried to resist. Other great nations tried to resist. Ashanti, Yoruba.
Mm-hmm.
There were many great nations, but because of trickery and playing one against another, divide and conquer.
Yeah.
And also technology, having the weapons, communications. They were able to set up these ports and then to begin to funnel millions of people across the Atlantic. And so what they call the Middle Passage, and that is the terrible transportation of people on these boats. Many of the people jumped off the boat into the ocean. Many people died. There are millions. Some say it could even possibly be 20 million people literally died
just
during this.
Just died in the ocean.
This is a Holocaust.
It's powerful.
And the effect on Africa, we're still feeling the effect up until today.
Mm.
It was literally drained of people.
Yeah.
Economies were changed. Empires were broken down. People are being carried across and brought the huge Portuguese colony in Brazil. And then the Spanish who were coming into the Caribbean and Central America. And then the British and the French and Dutch also coming into the United States and into some of the colonies.
Mm-hmm.
So all of the Europeans saw this is a way to make money fast.
Mm-hmm.
Because literally you encapture the people. They have no rights.
Mm-hmm.
They're slaves.
Yeah.
So they work for zero. So you have no output there. You just need to buy them.
Mm-hmm.
And then you feed them, you know, very weakly when they die, and they used to die at a young age, then you just get rid of them and get some more.
Mm.
So they literally did this and built up their plantations until it became what they call this vicious triangle. And that is between Africa to the Americas and then to Europe. And especially, see, with the British, they say, you know, Liverpool and some of the big cities were literally built with the blood of slaves. And so this is a terrible phase in history. But one of the worst aspects of this slavery is that for a period of time, in the early days, there were some Africans who were free. And they lived in the colonies as well.
Okay.
And some of them even had slaves, they said.
Mm.
But it reached a certain point, like in the 17th century, where they issued the Code Noir, which is the Black Codes, where they said anybody who is African is a slave, free or not, anybody. So they literally enslave all African people of all shades and colors and into slavery and to subjugation.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole concept of race entered into this slavery. And what was dangerous about it, it affected our language. When you say the word black, in the different languages in English, when you say black, it's being changed now, but it meant dirty, it meant negative,
scary.
Evil. You know, black magic versus white magic. What's the difference? The black is the evil one, right?
Yeah.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas.
Mm.
Right? So black meant dirty, evil, depressed, negative, and white meant innocent, pure, and holy.
Yeah.
So you say you're dreaming of a white Christmas and you live in Jamaica,
mm-hmm.
where there's no snow, right? They don't mean snow. What they mean is a holy Christmas.
Right.
So racism comes in because even the slave traders themselves had personalities.
Right.
And some of them went crazy. How can you do this to other human beings?
Mm.
But if when they subjugated them and when they justified it, they went into the Bible and they showed the story of Noah, Noah alayhi salam, that he was drunk. You know, and his son saw him naked, especially Ham, saw his nakedness, so he was cursed. And so he would be cursed, you know, the black son, that he would serve all of the other sons. So they felt that even biblically.
And that's from the Bible.
Yeah, this is a distorted version of what's left of the Bible.
Right, right.
And so this story of the curse of Ham was put on African people.
Mm.
So that European people thought that they are divinely ordained to enslave African people and to keep them down. And that type of racism still exists up until today.
Mm.
They're divinely ordained to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And so it justified it to them. And then the devil is always in dark clothes. Mm. And, you know, so good is white and bright and dark is, you know, evil.
Mm.
And so this justification happened and millions of people are brought into the Americas.
Mm.
And for a long time, we were taught that 100% non-Muslims.
Right.
Because Muslims have to be involved in slavery.
Right.
But now we are recognizing somewhere between 15 to 30% of the slaves, and you know, I tend to a 30%, almost one in every three who came across the Atlantic were Muslims. And this would have been shocking 40 years ago. But now, because of modern research methods and information coming to the surface, we are learning more and more about Muslims who came across and some of the events that happened.
So what happened to those Muslims who came across? Because obviously, you're talking about, you know, 15 to 30%, more likely on the on the higher end, 30% of these slaves who came across. How did these people survive? I mean, how did their Islam, did it aid them? Did they lose it? I mean, you know, there's so many questions. What was the fiqh around being a slave at that time? And how did they preserve their Islam? What happened to them?
Of course, slavery was a trauma. Because anybody who's taken as a slave in Africa generally felt, well, I have to live with this other society, and I might get married, I might work for this people, and I might eventually be able to earn my freedom and go back home, right? This is a shock, because you're put on a boat and you're taken across this ocean, and your name is taken away, your religion is taken away, your identity is taken away, a new, you know, way of life is given to you. You virtually have no chance to go back. So this is something completely different than before. And it is said that the first slaves were taken by the Portuguese, because the Portuguese and the Spanish were the first to come into the Americas. And around 1518 or so, but around 1522, there were slaves who were taken from what is now Senegal. And these people are what they call Wolof. And the Wolof, or the Senegalese, are very strong people. And they are Muslims. And so the Wolof were brought into Dominican Republic, what they call Hispaniola, which is Dominican Republic, Haiti, brought into that region, and then Puerto Rico and Panama, and they rebelled, major rebellions, right from the beginning. To the point where the Portuguese leadership said, no more Muslim slaves.
Too much to deal with.
Like, don't take any more, because it's within our lifestyle that when you see evil, you got to change it. You cannot submit to other people like this. And if people are trying to force Christianity on us, and say, we already have these stories. We have the Quran, which gives the true story of Jesus and Mary, the true story of Noah, the true story of creation. So that the Christian propaganda, the distorted version of Christianity, because it has nothing to do with Jesus, peace be upon him, but that distorted ham-based version wouldn't work on Muslims, because we have the true story of Noah.
We already knew what they were talking
about. We knew. So that didn't work. And we had prayer even more than the Christians. We had fasting. You know, we read the holy book. We have all the morality. So that wouldn't work on us. And this continued on in the Portuguese colonies and the Spanish colonies. In Jamaica, there were great rebellions that happened. And the Spanish called the slaves cimarrones. And from that comes the word maroon. And there was a maroon rebellion, you know, in Jamaica itself. Many of the maroons were Muslims. Some were Ashanti and Yoruba. The cimarrones concept, it's a wild horse, right? You can't control the horse. So that's what the Spanish called them. And interestingly enough, there was another rebellion in Mexico. This Gasper rebellion. And there were black Africans taken to Mexico. And they rebelled. And they won against the Spanish. There's a town in Mexico now, which was a free town up until today. It's the town of black people in Mexico. These are called Maroon Rebellions. And so this resistance, Muslims were one of the groups that led this resistance in the slavery period. It's not the only group. There were Yorubas. The Ashanti are very strong people. There's Coromante, there's Susu, there's so many different nations who were very strong as well and who rebelled and resisted slavery. But Muslims in particular, you know, made a very big contribution to the resistance.
And how was Islam taken away from them? Because obviously at that time, like you said, the distorted version of Christianity was used to justify, at least in the minds of the Europeans and the Christians at that time, the enslavement of other people. How did people slowly stop practicing Islam, because I mean, obviously now the descendants of people who perhaps came from that time don't maybe recognize that they once had Islam in their legacy. What happened to Islam? How did it slowly diminish from their understanding?
What we recognize is that one of the worst forms of evil that was perpetrated during this period was to strip a human being of his or her name, culture, identity. You are literally stealing the humanity, in a sense, from that person. Mm. And so the slavery was so vicious that people were put onto plantations and they were given other names. They were not allowed to use their African names, their Islamic names. Mm. They were not allowed to pray. They were not allowed to speak their language. A distorted version of Christianity was imposed upon them. Mm. And so, you know, at first it didn't work. The people sort of, they resisted in different ways. They would say they were Christian and then practice their Islam or Yoruba to themselves. Mm-hmm. They would poison the master's food. They would destroy, you know, his machinery. They would, some of them would just run away.
Right.
They would make rebellions. They would try to resist.
Mm-hmm.
But the evil and the you know, negative way of subjugation of people was so powerful that they literally tortured people and sometimes to death in front of the other slaves. Because they prayed, or because they fasted,
mm-hmm.
or because they wanted to be Muslim, or whatever their religion was, they wouldn't take on the name,
mm-hmm.
and they would separate families. So this is another evil. Mm-hmm. And marriage was not allowed, and some people don't recognize the fact that marriage was not allowed in America up until 1865 for black people. It was prohibited.
Mm.
Sometimes they let you jump over the broomstick.
Yeah.
But they can take away the mother or the children or the father at any point.
Mm.
And that's literally what they did. They separated the families, separated the children, and then he said, you are now Negroes. And Negro is this generic word, pejorative word, is like saying you're black, because Negro is negro in Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
So literally you're a color now. You're not a nation. You're not a religion. You have no lineage. And if the slave master's name was Johnson, then all of the slaves take the name Johnson.
Mm.
If his name was Williams, then all of the slaves take the name William. That is the reason why African Americans in all parts of the Americas have been stripped of their names.
Mm-hmm.
And they will have English names, French names, Spanish names, Dutch names,
mm.
based upon the colony or the plantation that they lived.
Mm.
So this was a systematic way of literally, you know, stripping the humanity,
dehumanizing
them until they're like a beast of burden.
Mm.
And so they literally, you know, tried to do this, but the people resisted,
mm-hmm.
And struggled against this dehumanization.
And amongst them, obviously, there were notables. I mean, there were scholars, even Islamic scholars,
mm-hmm.
that were brought over as slaves. Can you talk about some of the notable characters? There's a lot of people that I know about, I've heard about, that still resisted to the very end and actually
yeah.
brought Islam over to the Americas with them.
Yeah, actually, when you look at what happened, and again, scholars had to piece things together now, because especially in the Spanish colonies, they would destroy all literature
right.
except for their own. So scholars had to piece information together, and a number of eyewitness reports,
mm-hmm.
A number of documents written in Arabic language, and a number of different traces you could find. Like, for instance, when they call the slaves Mohammedans, Mahomet.
Mm.
When they use this word Mahomet, that was the Middle Age name for Muhammad.
Mm.
That's in the crusading times.
Right.
I was one time, I remember, I was in the Bahamas, in Nassau,
mm-hmm.
and I went to the archives, and I spoke to the leading scholar librarian,
mm.
and I asked her, do you have any writing in Arabic from the slaves? And she said, no. But we do have Amharic, That's the Ethiopian language. Yeah. So I said, okay, can I see the Amharic? Mm. So she brought documents, which were Arabic documents, written in the Maghrebi script of West Africa.
Really?
And it was the Surat al-Falaq and Nas and Qul Huwallahu Ahad.
And she thought it was Amharic.
Yeah, she thought it was Amharic, right? Because she didn't know the script of the Moroccan script, right?
Wow.
Which is what the West Africans wrote in.
Right.
And literally this slave was seeking refuge in Allah from the devil. Then she brought out this information on one of the islands. And it said, in the island of Exuma, which is an island now in the Bahamas, the majority of the slaves were followers of Mahomet. And it literally said the word. The majority of them. Which meant the majority of the slaves on that island were Muslims.
Right.
So you can piece it together. Also Mandingo. When they use the word Mandingo, this is a Mandingo slave.
Yeah.
It generally referred to the Mande, Mandinka Muslims. Again, coming from West Africa, Senegal, Gambia, you know, that region there, is Mandinka. You can also see in the names, like for instance, the name Abu Bakr. In West Africa, they say Bubakar.
Bubakar, yeah.
Right? And then that name turns into Buka. So you see like Booker T. Washington, right?
Right.
This name Buka is coming, we're tracing it through to Abu Bakr. We also found, for instance, on the coast of United States, that there was Saleh Bilali and Bilali Muhammad, famous Muslim leaders who had big families. And so the you know, the Bilali family, especially in the Sapelo Islands off the coast of Georgia, there were no slave masters named Bailey. They took that name, Bilali, and they said Bela, and then they said Bailey. So anybody named Bailey who lived in the Carolinas or Georgia was more than likely from this Bilali family.
Wow.
Okay, and we can trace it now. And it's interesting because Frederick Douglass, who was a famous African-American abolitionist,
right.
His mother was a Bailey. So literally, you can start to take the names, you'll get a poster of a runaway slave. And then you can see the Muslim name, and you can start piecing things together. Arabic documents come to the surface. We even have now whole Qur'ans written from memory of a slave.
Really?
The writing of the Maliki scholars, because they were basically Maliki in their jurisprudence. The Risala of Ibn Abi Zayd al-Qayrawani, written by slaves.
By hand?
By hand.
Wow.
And so they were literally circulating these documents amongst themselves, and information is coming to the surface, especially in Brazil, in the Caribbean, and we have some parts of the United States as well, documentation written. And so there are certain names of individuals that come to the surface. There's a few of them. I can give you a few of the famous ones.
Yeah.
For instance, you have Ayyub ibn Sulayman.
Okay.
And Ayyub ibn Sulayman, of course, they called him Job ben Solomon. Okay?
He's a butcher in his name.
Right. He was born in 1700 in Bundu. That's eastern Senegal.
Okay.
And he was enslaved and taken to Maryland. He was a scholar. And he literally, when he was enslaved in Maryland, he would pray five times a day. And he would write, you know, in Arabic. So the slave master realized, no, this person's not going to be a good field hand. So let me use him as an accountant and to keep the records, because he's really good with writing.
Right.
And his Arabic, you know, got to somebody in the government. And surprisingly enough, the American government had a treaty with the Sultan of Morocco, who had made a treaty with George Washington. And the first country to recognize the United States was Morocco. And within the treaty, it said any Moor, which meant Muslim, you know, from North Africa,
right.
but meaning Muslim, any Moor who was taken as a slave should be immediately released. So when the American government saw that this man was literate in Arabic and a scholar, they said, no, we're supposed to release him. So they released Ayyub ibn Sulayman, and he visited Washington, then he visited London, England. He wrote the whole Quran from his memory, and he returned to West Africa. Another famous West African scholar, leader, his name was Abdurrahman ibn Ibrahim. And he is called Prince Among Slaves,
yes,
right?
Yes, I've heard of
right? The Fortunate Slave, right?
Yes.
And there was a book written by Terry Alford, you know, about him, and there's also a docudrama that was done. He was born in Timbo, educated in Timbuktu. This is in what is now Guinea. Mm-hmm. And in 1762, he was enslaved in Mississippi. Mm. And he came into Mississippi, and when he looked at the plantation, he said, "This is ridiculous. We have our kingdoms are 10 times the size of this." But, and he was a prince, and the poor slave master who got control of him couldn't believe that he was actually an emir or a prince. Mm. So he just beat him down and said, "Okay, I'm going to call you prince." and he made him a slave. He tried to run away. He couldn't get away. Mm. It's a really emotional story.
Yes.
Finally, his writing was noticed by a newspaper producer. And he informed somebody in the government. When they recognized he was literate, they had him freed. Because that's the treaty.
Right.
And he eventually made it home. There's also the story of Yaro Mahmud, who was born in the 1700s. And he died at the age of 128. He 70 years as a slave. Yeah. Yaro Mahmud, you see his face. He still has like nur, like light coming out of his face. He's like the patriarch of African Muslim slaves in the United States. Then you have the story of Umar ibn Sayyid, who was a great scholar. He wrote so many of his documents in Arabic, his autobiography. His documents are in museums in the United States now. You can literally read his autobiography written in the Arabic language. You have Muhammad Kaaba, who was from a place called Buka, which is in Guinea. He's from the Malinka people. And he was studying to be a judge, a qadi.
Wow.
And he was captured at 20 years old, and he was deported to Jamaica. You also have Abu Bakr Siddiq, who was a scholar, studied in Timbuktu, which was a great center of learning.
University
of Sankore.
Yeah.
So he studied there. He was captured and brought to Jamaica. And some of his writings are actually available today.
Wow.
It's amazing, his story, because, you know, he says that, you know, "I come from a family of scholars, and we raise our children meticulously in mannerisms, and, you know, but I have been captured, and I just, you know," he said, "you know, ufawwidu amri ila Allah, you know, I just give my life to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala." And he was part of a group of Muslim scholars and slaves in Kingston, Jamaica, who were writing to other slaves in the countryside of Jamaica. And there was a magistrate who came from England, Robert Madden was his name, and he was overseeing the change from slavery to indentured labor. Because slavery was being abolished in the British colonies, and they were bringing in indentured laborers from India and Java.
Right.
So this was his job. He had served in Syria, so he knew some Arabic and he knew Muslims. Okay, so he came amongst these slaves, and he heard Arabic. So he gathered them all together, and he said to them, "La ilaha illallah." And he said, they all started saying the whole Quran. Then he said, "Quiet, who are you?" And they said, "We're Muslims." Then he recognized that there was a group of them in Kingston, Jamaica. And they were literally writing to the countryside. And it is around 1812, there's a document called Wathiqa, which was being circulated in the countryside of Jamaica. And literally, it caused a rebellion. Now, we are trying to trace this Wathiqa to a document made by a great scholar in West Africa, whose name was Sheikh Uthman Danfodio. And he wrote a document called Wathiqa Ibn Fudi Ila Ahl Sudan. This is the treatise of Ibn, the son of Fudi, Danfodio, to the people of Sudan, meaning the black people, the black regions, because there was Western Sudan and Eastern Sudan. This document called people to resistance in those days. And so this Wathiqa was being sent around in Jamaica. Boom, slave rebellion. You have this popping up all over the place. In 1835, and this is an amazing story, there were slaves taken from Nigeria, from the coast of Nigeria. Yoruba, Hausa, Fulani, but especially the Yoruba. And amongst these slaves were scholars. And they succeeded in the area called Bahia, in the Salvador region of Brazil.
Right.
They succeeded in opening up a territory, and they were governing the territory with Sharia law.
Wow.
And they had an emir, and they were literally, you know, had it, to the point where the Portuguese gave many of them boats and said, go back to Africa.
Like, we can't deal with you.
We can't handle you people anymore, right? And so you know what I found out? I was in Nigeria doing lectures, and I was taken to the Oba. This is like 2 years ago, the Oba of the Yoruba, which is the leading figure of the Yoruba religion.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out he's a Muslim.
SubhanAllah.
And I visited his palace in Lagos.
Mm.
And I mentioned to him about the slaves in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, no, we have a Brazilian mosques in Lagos. We have masjids in Lagos, Nigeria, built by Brazilian slaves who returned to Nigeria.
SubhanAllah.
And we still have the community now. And we celebrate
the ones
these
who had gone to Brazil, revolted, and then come back.
Come back. And you can pray in their masjid right now.
Wow.
It's an amazing story.
Really? Wow. Inshallah.
And Muslims, along with other people, they had forms of resistance. There was even a form of martial arts called capoeira.
Yes, yes.
And this is where they're sort of like dancing around.
Actually,
right,
I mean, a lot of hip-hop, you know, and break
right,
dancing.
Right, you break dancing, but you move, you know, like that, strike,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's this hidden resistance. Mm. Muslims were involved in this beginning of capoeira and the resistance movements in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
In Suriname, which is Dutch Guyana,
mm-hmm.
And that you have British Guyana, French Guyana, and Dutch Guyana. So in the Dutch part, there was a big slave revolt. This is another Maroon revolt.
Okay.
And a big revolt against the Dutch. And the leader of the revolt, his name was Arabi.
Arabi?
Yeah, like Arabi. Like an,
like
they
an
called
Arabi.
Him Arabi, right?
Wow, okay.
And they called him Bush Blacks.
Okay.
Right? And his one of his generals was called Zamzam. You know, like you drink Zamzam water from Mecca, right?
Yeah.
And they defeated the Dutch, and they went into the interior. And a treaty was made, and nobody ever conquered them. And recently, when I was in Guyana, Georgetown, a contingent came from Suriname.
Mm.
And this is a place, if we get a chance to visit it,
yes.
They came and they said, come to Suriname. We are the descendants of the Bush Blacks. We're coming back in Islam.
Allahu Akbar.
So there's hundreds of people returning to Islam, going to their roots, and recognizing what they have to give.
Mm.
Another interesting story is Haiti.
Okay.
Haiti is known for the great rebellion of Toussaint Louverture.
Mm.
But what is not so known is that the beginnings of the rebellion against the French in Haiti, which is Hispaniola, mm-hmm. you got Dominican Republic and Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the French side. It began on the plantations. And two of the great leaders in the plantation revolts was one called Macandal and another named Bookman. And these were called marabout.
Mm.
And that's sort of a Senegalese way of saying it's really murabit.
Okay.
From the murabitoun.
Right.
Which goes back to the great murabitoun movement.
Yes.
When they say it in Senegal, it means like a roving scholar,
okay.
Itinerant cleric.
Mm.
And so these marabouts began the resistance on the plantation. And it was the great general Toussaint Louverture who organized the resistance.
Mm.
And defeated the French, and it was the first African group in the Western world to win their independence and resisted all forms. And they're being punished up until now because of this resistance. But a lot of people don't realize that it was Muslims who were deeply involved with the Haitian Revolution.
And you say resistance, I mean, these are former captured slave peoples who are fighting with what? I mean, they don't even really have like weapons or anything, and they're fighting against, you know, the quote-unquote advanced European weaponry and stuff like that. So, I mean, their revolt in and of itself is really miraculous. Because
it was miraculous.
They were working against all odds.
That's right. But what a lot of people don't recognize is that many of the slaves are coming from highly organized societies.
Right.
And so, therefore, like in the case of Abdurrahman ibn Ibrahim, you know, from the Bundu area, from Timbo, he actually, he was an emir. He was captured after a battle. So they literally knew battle formations and everything, and they were organized, and they brought a lot of that resistance, that ability there. And it, and
these
it,
weren't bush people. These were,
these are serious fighters.
Yeah.
And it came out in Haiti with this great rebellion. You also have an interesting story of a woman. Her name was O. Lizzie Gray.
Okay.
And she was Muslim and well-known, and they forced her to accept Christianity. And so, you know, the missionaries like to make fun of Muslims. So they say, can you tell us something about Christ? And this is what old Lizzie Gray said. She said, Christ built the first church in Mecca, and his grave was there. Now, you have to realize they're talking in riddles.
Yes.
So she actually meant Medina, right? Because the knowledge is all pieced together. So who's the Christ? His first grave is in like Medina. His grave is there. She's talking about the Prophet Muhammad. That was Jesus to her.
Right.
Then you have the case of Abdurrahman, who the missionary, and we still have this document. The missionary says, I want you to write the Lord's Prayer in Arabic. He's making fun of him now, right?
Okay. Yeah.
So he said, okay. And then he wrote the Lord's Prayer. And the document says, this is the Lord's Prayer written at my request by, you know, the freed slave, by Prince, who has accepted Christianity. This is written in Arabic. Now, the Lord's Prayer, as we know, says, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, to the end. Which in Arabic should say, Rabbuna alladhi fis sama, something like that.
Right.
When you look at the document, it says, Lord's Prayer in Arabic, and you read the document, it says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. He wrote Al-Fatiha, which is the opening chapter of the Quran.
Allahu Akbar.
That's resistance, right?
That was the Lord's Prayer in his opinion.
So that is resistance. Now, you know, the slave master, the missionary said, you see, I made fun of him.
Yeah.
So up until the day of judgment, you will see his resistance, you know, which is there in the document. Another interesting story are the freed Mandingos, Mandinka, of Trinidad. Now, Mandinka people in West Africa, very strong nation. And that's why whenever somebody starts rebellion or if he's too muscular, they say, you're a Mandingo. Right? And it becomes like a wild buck.
Because I always thought it referred to like the fighting slaves.
Right. So
like
you say you're a wild buck. That's what they say, these NBA guys, slam dunking. LeBron James, Mandingo, right?
Right, right.
What it actually refers to is the Mande people, or Mandinka.
Okay.
And they are the people who actually traded in early times and spread Islam across West Africa. We even have proof of Mandinka coming across the Atlantic before Columbus, from the time of the great Mali Empire.
Right.
When Mansa Musa went, you know, to Mecca, but his predecessor Abu Bakr came across the Atlantic with 2,000 ships. So these Mandinka people made it into the Americas before Columbus. We have records of it. They even reached up into the United States. And so the slave masters would recognize them. And so whenever you see the word Mandingo being used, more than likely it was a Muslim. And so there were Mandingo Muslims, you know, who in the island of Trinidad, they formed, they freed themselves from slavery. And some of them actually, you know, joined the British regiments. Because there is... You know, the British were the first, you know, to end slavery and to, you know, give people ways of manumission where you could actually buy your freedom. So they literally bought their freedom early and they formed a society of Muslims outside of Port of Spain in Trinidad.
Okay.
And they were so successful in their growing of crops that Trinidad was reported to have had, you know, a great famine, and they were literally feeding the people of, you know, Trinidad, you know, back in this early time, 1700s, you know, feeding the people. And they used to go to the boats, and any Muslims that they would see, they would buy them, you know, free them, and then, you know, take them there. And so this was a major area. And it's interesting because, you know, it is Trinidad, of all the places in the Caribbean region, is where in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and up until now to a certain extent, the fastest rate of people coming into Islam, predominantly African Trinidadians, is actually is from Trinidad.
Right.
It's the fastest rate in the whole of the Americas.
Really?
They had probably a higher proportion than even the United States anywhere else.
Wow.
Because there's a strong tradition within their culture, the culture of Afro-Trinidadians. There's a very strong tradition from the Mandingo people. And you can literally see the ruins of masjids. You know, Yunus Bath is a famous Muslim. He had a community in Port of Spain. There's traces of his masjid there in Port of Spain. Mm. We had a big celebration for Yunus Bath there in Trinidad. So, I mean, Afro-Trinidadians can literally see the connection in their roots,
right,
which traces them right back, you know, to their Islam and all the way back to the early Islam.
Mm.
And so you find this in a number of places there in the Caribbean and in the United States, you know, some amazing stories of the Muslims.
And I think a lot of this puts into context the point that we're trying to get across with this series and celebrating the achievements. I mean, this idea of resistance, even in the face of such adversity, is really, I mean, a point of celebration. Like, that's something notable that we should be, you know, celebrating. The fact that these people, although they were put in that situation, mm-hmm. they were able to fight back, and that spirit of resistance still is something that today, as Muslims, we still should embody the face of adversity. So thank you, everyone, for watching. This is another great session. I hope you all were able to benefit, inshallah. Please do spread this knowledge with your friends and family, inshallah. Stay tuned for the last session coming up after this one, which is going to be something a little bit more relevant to today's society, inshallah. So please do stay tuned for that as well. Jazakumullah khairan for watching, and Jazakumullah khairan for Sheikh Abdullah for sharing this beautiful message with us. Hopefully we'll see you all next time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.